Hello and welcome. I'm excited to be here. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Boscalzo, and we're here for our cardiovascular and respiratory module.
Maybe you're asking,
why did you put cardiovascular and respiratory together? It seems like a lot to cover in one talk. And the reason was, as I tried to split it out, and I like to do the anatomy physiology piece, and they're so intertwined, and all the diagrams and pictures that I have are combining the two, so I figured I would put them together and we do it as one thing. So as usual, this is just education, not intended to replace a one-on-one consultation with a medical practitioner, and contact your practitioner if you want to make changes. So this is the module at a glance, how the cardiovascular and respiratory systems work. And as I go through a lot of this background with you from a functional perspective, and because it makes a difference if you understand how something works versus if you have just a cursory knowledge. So I'd like you to be able to kind of visualize where the different body parts are as people are coming in and talking to you about their lipid problem or their cholesterol problem or their recent heart attack or angina or whatever they may be having, that you have a clear sense of what the anatomy physiology is that's going on, and then what can go wrong. And that's a big piece of what we're looking at, is what can go wrong, not just from a physiological, anatomical perspective, but also from a functional and a nutritional perspective. And then assessment, we've gone through that before in our blood chemistry analysis, but there's additional assessments beyond blood chemistry. So we'll do a review of the blood chemistry, and then we'll look at what other assessments there are for cardiovascular and respiratory function. And then we'll end with the cardiovascular and respiratory systems balancing protocols. So what's the function? We all know what our heart is, and hopefully where our heart sits in our body and what our lungs are. But what's the real purpose of it is basically to build the combined system, cardiovascular, respiratory. They're charged with filtering the oxygen from the air, getting that oxygen into the blood, expelling the wastes, which are carbon dioxide and other things, and then delivering the oxygen to your body. So the respiratory part of that is the filtering the oxygen into the air and expelling the carbon dioxide and wastes, and that's the breathing part. And then the delivering the oxygen to your body, circulating nutrients, and then delivering wastes to the kidneys for removal is part of the cardiovascular system. So let's look at the anatomy of the cardiovascular and respiratory systems. We've got the central focus of the heart, which is charted with pumping blood out from it to the rest of the body. So it's got, coming into it, oxygenated blood from the lungs, and that would be the pulmonary artery. And then it's got the deoxygenated blood coming in from the tissues, and the oxygenated blood going out, so coming in from the lungs and then going out to the rest of the body. So we've got the heart. The arteries are the vessels that actually carry oxygenated blood and pump. They actually have pumping ability. The veins don't actually have a musculature, they don't pump. And they're pumped back by the muscles in the rest of the body. So when the blood goes out to the body, like if you're measuring your pulse at your wrist, that's an artery, that's an arterial pressure. That's the blood going down into the hands. The veins come back from the hands, they don't pump, but the contraction of the muscles in the arms and in the legs helps to move that blood back. And one of the things you might see with people is stasis, blood stasis. It's usually venous blood stasis. When you see people who have swollen ankles and they're kind of bluish, it's because they are not pumping back. It could be because there's blockages in those veins or because they don't have the musculature. A lot of times that's the problem when somebody is immobilized. They don't have the musculature to carry the blood back efficiently. Then we have the capillaries, which are the teeny tiny ones that actually go to the tips of the fingers, the tips of the toes. So if you even look at your arm, you look at your wrist, you've got these, I could see all my veins in my arms, and those go down into the hands. Well, in the hands, you don't see much of any. Well, at the top of the hands, I still do. But then the top of the hands go into the fingers, and all those little capillaries branch off of the arteries and the veins to bring blood either to or from the end tissue. And of course, we've got the blood, which is carrying the oxygen to the tissues so that they could survive, and carrying the nutrients to the tissues so they could survive. Then you've got your lungs. Your lungs are fed through the trachea, which is fed through the nose, and the air comes in through the nose, down the trachea, branches off into one of the lobes of the lungs. The lungs then take that oxygen and it pumps it into the blood, and the blood going out from the lungs goes right to the heart, and then the heart will pump it to the rest of the body. So they work in unison, which is why we put it together, the cardiovascular system, because they are so intimately connected. We'll look at that in a little bit more detail. So if we look at the heart, it's got four chambers. The two ventricles pump blood out of the heart, and the two atria receive blood into the heart. Okay? So then we have four valves, and the valves are between the different sections. We have the aortic valves, the pulmonic, the mitral, and the tricuspid. And if you have people come in and you're doing a history, one of the things you might see a bunch of is something called mitral valve prolapse. And that's where that valve between the left atrium and the left ventricle is having a problem, and there's some blood that regurgitates back up through it. So if you were to listen to the valves, because when we're listening to the heart, we're usually listening to the valves, you'd hear that, which would indicate that there's a little bit of backflow from the left ventricle into the left atrium, whereas it should be going one way. So remember, the atria receives blood into the heart, and then the valves direct and control the flow between the atria into the ventricle, and the ventricle sends it back out. You've got the big vein that's coming up, like all the branches of the veins coming up from the extremities are going into the superior vena cava. The vena cava then takes that blood, that's deoxygenated blood, takes it into the right atrium, which goes into the right ventricle. The ventricle then pumps it out through the pulmonary artery to the lungs so that the lungs can then oxygenate that. Then it comes back through the pulmonary vein and goes into the left atrium. And then the atrium allows that blood to go into the ventricle. And then that gets pumped out through the aorta, which is the main vessel coming off the heart. And then there's branches to all different parts. There's branches that go up, like to the carotid artery, things like that, coming up into the neck to supply the brain, and then to go down into the extremities. So that's basically how it works. So let's do another review of this. You breathe. And then the air that you breathe in goes into the lungs. That's infused into the blood. And it goes out from the lungs through the pulmonary vein, goes into the left atria of the heart. The atria then supplies the blood down into the ventricle. The heart pumps, and it allows the blood to go out to the aorta, service the rest of the body. And then as it's coming back, it's coming up through the inferior vena cava from below, and there's veins that feed it from above and below. The vena cava then puts the blood into the right atrium. The right ventricle then pumps it out to the lungs to be reoxygenated. So it's a constant cycle. And the way the heart works is there's a pump and then there's a rest. A pump and then there's a rest. And if you've ever measured anybody's blood pressure, you know that there's the diastole and systole. The systolic is the pressure that is on the vessels when the heart is pumping. And the diastolic is when the heart is at rest. So systole and diastole refer to the phases of the heart pumping, the heartbeat. So during systole, the heart contracts. It pushes the blood out of the lungs and out of the arteries. It's 1/3 of the cycle. So actually 2/3 of the cycle is the rest. So 1/3 of the cycle, and that's the upper number on the blood pressure. So you can see what's happening by the arrows here, right? It's pumping the blood out through the aorta and out through the pulmonary artery. So then diastole is when the heart relaxes. Ah, It fills with blood. It fills with blood where from? It fills with blood from the extremities, and it fills with blood from the lungs. That's two-thirds of the cycle. That's the lower number on the blood pressure, and then it goes back to the systole. So systole, diastole, systole, diastole, systole, diastole. That's the way it all works. So you can see there's a lot of room for error. Now, I wanted to say, too, we're talking about blood vessels. There's also the blood vessels that supply blood to the muscles of the heart, because the heart muscle itself, like any other end organ or extremity, needs a blood supply and it needs a nutrient supply. Okay, so the arteries that get blocked when someone has a heart attack are generally not these. They're not the aorta or the pulmonary artery. It's the vessels that actually supply the muscle of the heart. And so when you've got a blockage, say via a cholesterol buildup, you've got the muscles to the heart get hurt, and the heart, actually you get what's called ischemia, the loss of oxygen to parts of the heart, and that affects the heart's ability to contract. So here's a listing of the major blood vessels. We just talked about them. Now we're going to see them in a little bit more detail. On the artery side, there's the coronary artery that supplies the heart. There's the pulmonary that goes to the lungs, and then there's the carotid that goes up to the head. And then you've got the vena cava, which is the major venous return vein. And they're a lot bigger than the veins you see when you look at your arms, or even if you have somebody with a varicosity in their legs. That vena cava is a big, good-sized diameter. Then the pulmonary vein, and then the jugular, which is the return flow from the head. You know, you've heard the comment, get them in the jugular, right? That's the venous return from the head down into the heart, and it feeds back into the vena cava. Okay, so there's the superior vena cava that services from the brain. There's the inferior vena cava that comes from down below, anything down below. Then you've got the right pulmonary arteries and the left pulmonary arteries. And you've got because there's two lobes to the lungs, those feed in. And then you've got the right and the left pulmonary veins. Here's the vascular system as a whole. There are a lot of things we'll talk about when we talk about what can go wrong, but blockages in these vessels are what cause most of the problems. So it could be an aneurysm, which is a bulging in the vessel, and sometimes it bursts. So burst aortic aneurysm is deadly. And there could be blockages like a cholesterol plaque. Okay, so aneurysms. Embolisms refer to when there's a blood clot that gets up and into the lungs. Okay? And oftentimes that happens when somebody's in bed and they're immobilized and they're not contracting, relaxing, especially after surgery. There'll be some clotting of the blood and you basically get an embolism that goes up. So you see that we've got the common carotid, left and right, that goes up into the brain, the main one. Then you've got the left and right internal jugular, which comes down from the head. You've got the brachial, which comes up from the arm. So all the little vessels in the arm branch out of the brachial. So the brachial artery supplies the arm. You've got the left and the right. You've got the right and the left renal vein, and that takes the blood supply from the kidneys. You've got the inferior vena cava, which supplies the whole rest. You can see it branches. But the aorta, which is the red one, comes down and it branches into left and right to go to the legs. The vena cava comes up from, it takes the blood coming up from each of the legs. Then you have the common iliac artery, which supplies the ileum and down into the legs. And then you've got the iliac veins. And then the femoral, which is what you would test, and that's going down, further down, and in the back of the leg, you can take pulses. We've got the basic anatomy of the system, and you could go into more depth if you wanted to study more about that basic anatomy and physiology. I think it's important to have an understanding of how it works. You know, the basic overall, the names of the vessels, what they do, that the veins and the arteries are important and they're different. One carries oxygenated, one carries deoxygenated, the role and the interplay between the lungs and the heart. But then once you get into the blood itself, there's other issues that go on. So there's issues that can go on inside the blood vessels, which we'll talk about in a bit. But one of the things that is carried in the blood that can create problems for the cardiovascular system are the lipids. And most people, that's what they know. When they hear about heart problems, they think about cholesterol, right? Cholesterol is the thing that causes heart disease. And in fact, we're going to kind of debunk that. So let's talk about some of the blood lipids. We'll get into what they are, and we'll get into a little bit more in depth on that when we look at how you measure. So the various blood lipids of importance are cholesterol, which has been marked the bad guy, like get your cholesterol as low as possible, has been, or was up until maybe the last decade, the popular press thing, and it still is among a lot of people. That's the key to having a healthy heart, is getting your cholesterol as low as possible. Indeed, that's a misnomer, because if your cholesterol goes too low, you're going to have problems with hormones. Remember our chart from our hormone module, where cholesterol sat at the very top, and cholesterol then got converted into pregnenolone, which got converted into progesterone, which got converted and went the other way and got converted into DHEA and testosterone and estrogen. And all of those sex hormones are affected by cholesterol and your response, your ability to respond to stress. Because remember, cortisol is one of those steroids that's basically a grandchild of cholesterol. So cholesterol is super important. However, your body makes cholesterol. It just needs the building blocks. So someone who's on an extremely low-fat diet will not make enough cholesterol to supply themselves. Somebody who's on an extremely high-fat diet with lots of animal products in there is going to be, in addition to what their body makes, is going to have way too much cholesterol. And the thing about cholesterol, in addition to being a precursor to your hormones, cholesterol is also an antioxidant. And cholesterol can go out and actually heal the damage in the blood vessels. The problem is, when we get into lipid imbalances, is that the cholesterol, there's too much cholesterol that's in the vessels and not being dragged away. So it's supposed to go out, the LDLs, which are low-density lipoproteins, carry the cholesterol to the bloodstream, and they're in the vessels, and then the HDLs carry it back. So if you've got an imbalance, which we'll talk about when we look at the blood work, you've got an imbalance between HDLs and LDLs, and you've got too many LDLs and not enough HDLs, and they're carrying out the cholesterol to the bloodstream, maybe for a good reason, to try to heal some damage there, that cholesterol gets stuck there. It stays there when you don't have enough HDLs to take it back to the liver and then be excreted. So that's when we get into trouble with the cholesterol, HDL, LDL, and all that balance. And hopefully by the end of today, that'll be clear. So in addition to cholesterol, we've got triglycerides. And triglycerides are basically a storage of fat in the blood. It's basically when you've eaten a lot of food, sugar, carbohydrate, food, and that needs to be converted to energy. And it basically, either you have insulin resistance, and so it's not getting into the cells, it's staying in the blood, or you're just eating plain darn too much, then those glucose molecules get turned into triglycerides, which is a fat. So the glycerin, the glyceride, is actually the sugary component. So it's a storage. It's a storage form. When we say that the sugars in your blood get converted to fat for storage, it's in the form of triglycerides. So they will be circulating in the blood before they reach the fat cells and then get stored there. When someone has an elevated triglyceride number, it's most often as a result of poor sugar handling, too much sugars and juices and carby kind of foods, and sometimes too many calories, like overeating. But it's not always overeating. It can be a metabolic imbalance of their ability to take those sugars and get them into the cells, as we have in insulin resistance and diabetes. Okay, that's why triglycerides are elevated with diabetics. And if we remember the continuum we talked about from just plain insulin resistance up to diabetes, there was in between something called metabolic syndrome. So metabolic syndrome is basically insulin resistance, but where you've got the changes in the lipids. And then when you get full-blown diabetes, you continue to have those changes in the lipids. Elevated cholesterol, low HDLs, high triglycerides, high LDLs. So this is the pattern, and the connection between blood sugar and blood lipids is very intimate. So triglycerides, the numbers when you're looking at a lab, the triglycerides should be half of the cholesterol. So if you figure a good cholesterol level might be, say, 150, the triglycerides should be about 75, and the HDLs should be about 75. That's a really good, healthy blood lipid profile. Cholesterol, 150, triglycerides, 75, HDL, 75. Now, do we ever see those perfect numbers? Rarely. Okay. So, but if the HDLs are lower than the triglycerides, that's a sign of insulin resistance, and that can lead to insulin resistance as well as be a result of insulin resistance. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit more about the lipoproteins, which is HDL, LDL, VLDL, and then the apolipoprotein A and B, and we'll talk about that on the next slide. Okay, so these are a class called lipoproteins. And lipoproteins are a combination of cholesterol and proteins. So this is a list broken out off that original list that we just saw. These are called lipoproteins. So it's fat with protein. And when you look at that fat, a lipoprotein can be a high density, meaning there's a lot of protein in relationship to fat, because fats are not dense. The proteins are dense. So when you have high density lipoproteins, that means there's more protein than fat. The low density lipoproteins have more fat than protein. The very low density lipoproteins, the VLDLs, have even more of that. And we'll look at these in a little bit more detail, more of the fat. And the high density lipoproteins are the desirable ones. You want your numbers for the HDLs to be higher than the LDLs and VLDLs. VLDLs are not routinely measured on the standard blood profiles, but there is a test called the VAP, the VAP Vertical Analyzer Profile. Don't ask me where they got that name from, but it goes into a lot more details on breaking down the lipids, and we'll take a look at what that looks like in a little bit. Then you've got the apolipoproteins, A and B. And again, like the desirables versus the undesirables, apolipoprotein A is more desirable than apolipoprotein B because the apolipoprotein A is associated with HDLs versus the B, which is associated with LDLs. So let's look at HDL, LDL, and VLDL. HDLs are the high-density lipoproteins. Like I said, that means that they have the higher proportion of protein to fat. Their charge is to take cholesterol away from the cells and just transport it back to the liver for removal. When you hear people talk about the good cholesterol, they're talking about HDL. And technically, it's not cholesterol. It's the high-density lipoprotein. It's slightly different in structure. It's not a steroid. The LDLs, the low-density lipoproteins, they deposit cholesterol in the artery walls. Well, why do they do that? Is that like just so that we can get clogged up? No, there's a purpose. There's a purpose for bringing the cholesterol to the tissue. Well, first of all, we have to get cholesterol out to our glands that make our hormones, right? Our adrenal glands, the ovaries, the testes, where they make those steroid hormones. So the cholesterol has to be taken out to the tissues for that reason. The LDLs are what transports it out to the tissues. When it gets into the arteries, because cholesterol is such a potent antioxidant, it can heal damage to those arteries. So sometimes when the cholesterol is elevated, it isn't necessarily because the person ate too much steak the night before. It could be because the body perceived a damage that needed to be fixed and started producing more cholesterol and sending it out there. So we can't always go for the Western medicine approach, which is let's just lower the cholesterol. We got to look at why is the cholesterol elevated. So if the cholesterol is elevated because the person's eating 4 eggs and a pound of bacon for breakfast every morning, then yeah, we want to lower the cholesterol, not by giving that person a drug, but by removing those offending substances, which, by the way, especially the bacon will anyway, it will cause damage to the vessel walls because of the processed fats, the oxidized fats that are in there, plus the preservatives and things like that. So the LDLs, when they're high, it indicates that there's a lot of cholesterol being delivered to the system. So when they talk about the HDL and LDL as cholesterol, it's because it's attached to the cholesterol. So how much of the cholesterol in the blood is attached to LDLs versus how much of the cholesterol in the blood is attached to HDLs? Because the cholesterol itself cannot circulate because it's not fat in and of itself. It has to be attached to the fats in order to be transported in the bloodstream. So that's that. And then there's the VLDLs. And the VLDLs contain the highest amount of triglycerides. And those, the higher the VLDLs, the worse the lipid profile, because that causes the cholesterol to be built up on the walls of the arteries. And we'll look at that a little bit more when we look at the assessment pieces and we look at the VAP and what those numbers should be.
You know how it's said that a picture is worth a thousand words? Well, because this science is so complicated with HDLs and LDLs and the lipoproteins, I thought I'd share some pictures so you get a sense of what this is really like. The first one is an up-close of a split of the blood vessels, and what you're seeing is the cholesterol being transported through the blood system by either LDLs or HDLs. And so they're basically transport carriers. Remember that cholesterol is a sterol. It's a lipid and it cannot make it through the bloodstream without a protein carrier. Same with the hormones, right? The steroid hormones, your estrogen, progesterone, and all those. Those need a protein carrier. Thyroid hormone, they all need a protein carrier. So the protein carrier for cholesterol are the lipoproteins. What you're seeing here is the LDL and the HDL transporting cholesterol through the system. So let's take a closer look at these particles. So this is all of the phospholipids. So we have that big one on the end. Remember, look how big that one is compared to everything else. That's called a chylomicron. And chylomicron's main function is to transport lipid particles through the intestinal wall so they can get to the rest of the body. And certain types of fats, particularly medium-chain triglycerides, don't require bile to emulsify them. They can just be picked up right through the chylomicrons. Then we have VLDLs, so that's the very low density. And on the other end, we have the HDLs, and those are the high density. And recall, as I said before, that the high density means that they have more protein, less lipid. Very low density has more lipid, less protein. So let's look at another picture which gives those again and names them. So again, we have the chylomicron, and it gives you the size. So it's very much different, like 1,000 nanometers compared to HDLs, which are only 10. So we have the HDLs, the LDLs are low density, the intermediate density, and then we have the VLDLs, which are the very low density. Finally, here's the up close on the inside of what a lipoprotein looks like. And you can see that there's a surface and a core. And the core contains cholesterol ester and triglycerides. The outer part contains apolipoproteins, because remember, these are the part that's got to attach to the cholesterol to carry it around. And of course, there's the free cholesterol, which binds to it, and then phospholipids. And we did a lot of detail on phospholipids in our macronutrients module.
Then we have a category of lipids called the apolipoproteins. Now, obviously, they have both fat and protein. Lipoprotein, lipo for lipid, protein for protein. And it's basically the A's and the B. The A is, it's a structural protein, and it's about 70% of the protein that's in the high density lipoproteins. So if you have an elevation in apolipoprotein A, it's going to be related to HDL. So we want the ratio of the A's to the B's to be higher. On the B's, they're primarily a component of LDL, and they carry the cholesterol to the tissue.
Let's switch gears now and go into a little bit more detail on the anatomy of the respiratory system. So here you have a picture, and it's got the two lungs, and you see the nose. Nose is part of the respiratory system. The nose leads into the pharynx, which is in the back of the throat. The larynx isn't officially a part of the respiratory system, but it's there. Then you go down into the trachea. The air comes in through the nose. It goes down into the pharynx, down past the larynx, and down into the trachea. The trachea then splits. It splits to the left lung and the right lung. When the trachea splits to go into the lungs, it becomes the bronchi. So you have two bronchi, the left and the right. The bronchi then split further into the bronchioles and eventually into the alveolar sacs. The alveolar sacs are actually where the oxygen exchange happens between the air and the bloodstream. And we'll go into a little bit more detail about that. But the alveolar sacs are lined with capillaries, right? So the exchange can happen. And you can see that on the picture here. The diaphragm is included in this picture just to show you the relative relationship. So all this is happening above the diaphragm. When you inhale, the diaphragm comes down to allow for the expansion of the lungs. And then when you exhale, the diaphragm moves back up to contract when there's less air in the lungs. What's the function of the respiratory system? Well, it's to deliver oxygen to the cells, right? That's its main function. So it breathes the air in and then delivers the oxygen to the cells and then removes the excess carbon dioxide. And the main structures, like I said, nasal cavity, trachea, and lungs. So what happens when people breathe? Well, first of all, humans breathe about 900 breaths an hour. That's 21,600 breaths per day. So this is a really important process. It's controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system, so people don't have to remember to breathe. Of course, they can hold their breath, but after a time, that just doesn't work anymore because you're forced to breathe in because the body, the buildup of the carbon dioxide. So it's hard to hold your breath and die only if somebody else is holding you, like preventing you from breathing. And that's called suffocation. So the oxygen crosses the lungs tissue. It's in the air, and then it crosses the lungs tissue at the alveolar level and enters the bloodstream and then travels to the organs and tissues. It's exchanged for carbon dioxide. So when a person exhales at those same alveolar sacs, the carbon dioxide is removed from the bloodstream and expelled in the exhale. And the carbon dioxide is a waste product. It exits the cells, enters the bloodstream, travels back to the lungs, and then it's expelled. So that's how breathing works. And it's a, would you say, a pretty important process? So how is breathing regulated? Well, there's voluntary and involuntary. Fortunately, we have involuntary, right? So we don't have to think about breathing. It just happens. And it's controlled by the respiratory center in the brain. And that respiratory center is detecting the level of carbon dioxide. So that center controls how often a breath is taken, how much air is inhaled and exhaled. And of course, it's based on the carbon dioxide content. Now, this can be trained. There are a number of breathing techniques out there that you may want to look into if you're working with clients who have breathing problems, respiratory problems, you know, air gapping, and some of the other issues that we'll talk about later. But it can be overridden when somebody's speaking. They can, you know, take a bigger breath than normal, and they can hold the breath longer. Singing, certainly, and swimming underwater. I have a funny story about the swimming underwater. When my kids were little, we had over some friends, and they were all swimming in the pool, and then we got into the hot tub, and they were having a contest as to who could hold their breath the longest. So I was impressed, and everybody was holding their breath a decent amount of time, until this one little girl, she's probably 8 at the time, went under, and I'm timing, and it got to a minute, and I'm watching. It got to 2 minutes. I got scared. She was underwater holding her breath for over 2 minutes. So I reached down and pulled her up. I didn't know what was happening down there. And she got mad. Well, I was trying to see how long I could hold it. I said, honey, you were over 2 minutes. Way beat everybody. But it was scary. But it was scary for me because I didn't know. I'm like, she still is okay. She's moving around. But I didn't know if there was a problem. So I pulled her up. But I've never seen anybody. I mean, there are certainly trained athletes and all who probably hold their breath for that long. But a little 8-year-old girl was kind of interesting. What's inhalation? Well, what happens is the diaphragm, which we just looked at, goes down, it descends, and that creates a negative pressure in the lungs, and that allows the body to draw in the air from outside through what? The nose or the mouth. Mouth breathing is not necessarily recommended, but some people do it because they have sinus issues and they have a hard time breathing through the nose. The air enters through the nasal cavity or through the mouth at all the same place. It goes down into the pharynx. It's warmed when it goes in because obviously the body needs to warm it unless, of course, you're in a situation where you're in the desert and the temperature is over body temperature. It's humidified from the moisture in the mucous membranes, and then it helps to equilibrate the air to the body condition. So that's what the upper part of the respiratory system does. Cold air can cause problem. It can cause things to dry out. It can just cause a problem. So we have to equilibrate. And that's part of the respiratory system's function. The other thing that's part of its function is it removes particulate matter. Now, you know, we breathe in air. There's dust, there's dirt, there's pollen, there's all sorts of things in the air. So the function of that upper part of the respiratory system is to remove the particulate. And that's done by all the hairs and the mucus and the cilia, the kind of beating little hairs that can take that air from the outside, have it through the nose, and it comes on down. The air is chemically sampled by the sense of smell. That's kind of interesting, right? So when we smell things, the body's saying, noxious, safe. Smells good, I want to eat it. Doesn't smell too good. Smells dangerous, like the fumes of gas or other things that we've come to detect. So that's part of the respiratory system as well. What's pulmonary ventilation? Well, that's another fancy name for breathing. And basically, the inhalation serves a lot of purposes in addition to bringing oxygen into the respiratory system. We know that the respiratory system is coated with mucus. It's got the IgAs in that mucus to help protect us if there's pathogens and also allergens. And it's coated with that mucus, so it prevents our tissues from being in direct contact with the air. It's our savior. It's our little protector. The mucus contains a lot of water, and air picks up water. So it picks up that water, and that helps it to warm. It helps it to humidify, and it helps to remove the particles. So these are all important functions that are protective, that prevent damage to the trachea and the lungs by this air. It's basically a foreign matter, right? It's like food. We're taking this in. The body has to say, is this okay? Or is this not okay? How can I prepare it to be gentle and helpful to my body? So here's an up close on the trachea, the anatomy of the trachea. You can see where the larynx is right there at the bottom. It's like the transition between the pharynx and the trachea. It's very cartilaginous. You can see that by the, and muscular. It's got those little rings in the diagram, and it splits. That's called bifurcation, splitting, and it splits and goes down into the bronchi. So we've got the primary bronchi, and then we have the secondary bronchi, which those primary bronchi split into several divisions. And then finally, those split into a bronchiole. It's kind of like a tree, right? You've got the trunk, the trachea would be the trunk. And then you've got the main branches. Those would be the bronchi. And then you've also got those next level branches, the little ones, and finally the twigs. So that's what the trachea looks like. And that goes down into the lungs and is what helps us with oxygenating the blood. So the trachea, you know, the air passes through the pharynx and past the larynx and makes its way to the trachea. The main function is, guess what? Funnel the inhaled air down to the lungs, the exhaled air back out of the body. It's cylinder-shaped, 25 to 30 centimeters, and it sits in front of the esophagus. And that's an important thing to know as well. You know, when you're dealing with somebody who's having some breathing problems or coughing problems or throat problems, to know the esophagus, when it gets inflamed, can actually put pressure on the trachea as well and make breathing a little bit more difficult. pierce some more on the anatomy and the function. They're incomplete cartilage rings and smooth muscle. So that's important to keep the airway open. We don't want that airway collapsing on us, do we? The smooth muscle can contract, decrease the diameter, or increase the diameter. And that causes air to rush up from the lungs at a greater force. We want to be able to expel forceful exhalation, right? And then what, you know, if you ever get mucus in your throat, you do that really forced exhalation to get that mucus out. And that's facilitated by the smooth muscular rings in the trachea. The trachea is lined with these mucus producing what's called goblet cells, and they have ciliated epithelia. What does that mean? Well, epithelia is the lining, and we have epithelial linings in all of our organs. And the cilia are these little hairs that beat, and they help to move particles. The mucus catches the particles. And when we have a buildup of mucus, like say you're allergic to pollen and you're exposed to pollen, that mucus grabs it and protects the body from it, protects it from going down in the lungs. That's really what the upper respiratory system function is, in addition to pulling in the air, but it's also to protect us from everything going down into the lungs. Now, sometimes that doesn't happen. Somebody gets an upper respiratory infection, a sinus infection, they're coughing, they're sneezing, and their immune system is weak, and that goes down and becomes a problem in the lungs or the bronchioles, right? Bronchioles, bronchitis is one of those inflammations. Pneumonia is in the lungs themselves. So here's the anatomy of the lungs. We got the trachea coming down, like I said, splits into the primary bronchi, splits into the bronchioles, and the diaphragm controls breathing, controls everything about breathing in and out, up and down. And what happens with folks, and these are the things you're going to see in practice, is that they're stressed. They don't do diaphragm breathing. They breathe and they use the muscles in their neck. So they end up with neck and shoulder strain, and they end up with small exchange. They don't get as much oxygen to the tissues, which leaves them feeling tired and fatigued. So it's really important to teach your people how to use their diaphragms in breathing. The belly should come out. Yes, women who are vain and don't want their belly coming out any more than it already does, that's the way you should be breathing. That's how you fill your lungs with air and oxygenate the tissues. So this is an important piece for you to be teaching your people. The right lung is actually larger than the left one. It contains three lobes. The left one contains two. It's a spongy consistency. It's got the muscular diaphragm below it that controls the breathing. So here's an up close on the bronchi. So the trachea bifurcates, like I said, air enters the lungs through the primary bronchi. The primary bronchi divide, you could see that. And you can see all the little thin, like twigs, right? Think of them as twigs. That's the bronchioles. And smaller and smaller diameter as they split. And they eventually make it in to the alveoli. Let's now take a look at the structure of the bronchi and the bronchioles. The bronchi, just like the trachea, is made of cartilage and smooth muscles. The bronchioles, on the other hand, have more elastic fibers in place of the cartilage. And that's so they can expand more and be more elastic. The nervous system controls the constriction and the relaxation of the bronchioles and the bronchi. But here's the thing, it's the opposite of what we would expect. The contraction is caused by the parasympathetic nervous system. They're controlled by acetylcholine. The relaxation is controlled by the sympathetic. So we really think about, in terms of general stuff, the sympathetic just causes everything to contract and constrict, and the parasympathetic causes everything to relax. But it's opposite here, so keep that in mind. And what happens when people like get into bronchospasm and they have, like, say, an asthma attack, it really works well to give them caffeine, which stimulates the sympathetic nervous system. The terminal bronchioles are at the end of each of the bronchioles. They subdivide into what's called the respiratory bronchioles. those are teeny tiny. So whereas the terminal bronchioles, the bronchioles themselves are actually up to 1 millimeter. These are actually less than 0.5 millimeters. And they lack cartilage, and therefore they need to rely on the inhaled air to support their shape. The respiratory bronchioles, each one divides into alveolar ducts. The alveolar ducts is where the action is, because at the end of each alveolar duct is an alveolar sac. So let's look at that. So the alveolar ducts are at the end of each respiratory bronchial. Those lead into alveolar sacs, which are really tiny. They're 200 to 300 microns in diameter, and they look like a cluster of grapes, but this is where the action is. Let's look at the action, okay? The action is what? Gas exchange. What's the function of alveolar ducts? Gas exchange. They're in direct contact with the capillary. They're surrounded by capillaries, and the purpose of that is to allow the oxygen from the air to be diffused into the blood and the carbon dioxide to be diffused away from the blood. While the diameter of the alveolar ducts is very tiny, because of the way it's structured with these grapes and they're all clustered together, you actually increase the surface area to 75 to 100 meters squared. That's huge. It's similar to like in the small intestine that we've studied, where you've got the microvilli and they have so much surface area, it's like the size of a football field. And this is so that we can actually do very massive gas exchange very efficiently without having to have these huge chests and these huge lungs. So let's look at the structure and function of these alveoli. So the alveolar sac, which looks like the bunch of grapes, is surrounded by these capillaries. But I want you to really make sure you understand this, because the pulmonary vein is actually containing oxygenated blood, and the pulmonary artery contains deoxygenated blood. And the reason for this is the naming of veins and arteries has to do with the direction of flow from the heart. Now, typically, the blood flow from the heart is what? It's oxygenated. But in the case of the lungs, where they are actually doing the oxygenation, the heart is pumping back to the lungs the deoxygenated blood, so the carbon dioxide can be removed and the oxygen can be put in. So the pulmonary vein is what contains the oxygenated blood, right? Because that's going back to the heart. The pulmonary artery contains deoxygenated blood. And this is where the action is, right, guys? This is where the oxygen, the gas exchange, this is where the gas exchange occurs. Air is pulled in, goes, it makes its way all the way down to these alveoli. The alveoli take the oxygen out of it, put it in the bloodstream through the capillaries and then into the pulmonary vein, to go back to the heart so the heart can pump it out. And then the deoxygenated blood gets pumped right back to the lungs. It goes to the alveoli. The carbon dioxide is removed, expelled through exhalation, and there we have it. So that's the story of respiration. That's the story of circulation. And you can see now why I put these two together instead of having separate modules on each, because they're so intimately connected. In the next part of this module, we're going to talk about what can go wrong with this process that we just outlined. See you on the next part.